Cambridge Breakfast with Shutterly Fabulous. No other shutters come close.
The former BBC journalist Malcolm Brabant developed psychosis from a yellow fever jab. With the help of his wife and fellow journalist Trina Villerman, his descent and rise is captured in a documentary feature that premieres at the Cambridge Film Festival on Wednesday. When I spoke to Malcolm, I wanted to know how their journey began.
I went into our local clinic to have this yellow fever vaccine because I was required to have it to be able to go to West Africa. I was supposed to be doing an assignment for UNICEF, the children's charity, to look at child soldiers. And within 18 hours of having this vaccine, things had started to go wrong. I was burning up, and eventually the vaccine fried my brain.
Mm. And the psychosis element of all of this, have you any sort of family history? I don't know, cousins, aunts, uncles?
No, I have absolutely no history of mental illness in my family. You know, we've spoken to psychiatrists, and they say that if you had had something genetic, it would have, you know, manifested itself much, much earlier. And we are absolutely convinced that it was the vaccine which triggered the psychosis, simply because of the timing and because of what happened to me during the 13 days that I had this dreadful fever. After I had the vaccine, I had a temperature of 40 degrees Fahrenheit, 103 or 104 sometimes, 104, and it really didn't vary very much during that time. And I was deprived of sleep for 6 or 7 days. We couldn't get the temperature down, and eventually I started to hallucinate, which is a common sort of thing that some psychiatrists see, which is when that you do have these kind of tropical diseases and the temperature that lasts that sort of, you know, amount of time, then your brain starts to break away from the tethers that tie it to sanity, and that's when insanity begins.
Because many people, I've had the yellow fever jab myself, and all I ended up with was a sore arm. And one would assume, first journalists will never assume, that if many people were suffering like this, then there would be inquiries, and NICE and all their equivalents would be making sure that basically somebody else's yellow fever jab was used.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that you know, mine was a rare event, I think quite possibly. But we don't really know the true extent of it. This is the problem. My wife carried out an investigation while I was sick to try to, you know, determine whether or not this was a common thing. And she struggled to get any information out of the World Health Organization. She looked at the sort of... and eventually she got some figures saying that you know, there were about 400 adverse events over a period of 10 years involving mental illness. Now, what's really interesting about this is that none of these figures came from sub-Saharan Africa. There was absolutely no reporting of this kind. Now, it may be perfectly sort of so that there were no cases, but what I think happens is that there is no reporting of adverse events in Africa because life is very perilous there. So, you know, in my heart, and I'm not able to prove this, I believe that, you know, it's probably much worse than this. And we have also heard, you know, hearsay stories that Sanofi Pasteur, the pharmaceutical company, actually knows that it can cause this problem in middle-aged men.
And in your own case, the madness, which is an understatement, really, I suppose, you had the first period, but then it returned later on as well.
Yeah, there were several phases of madness, and the... You'll hear a psychiatrist in the film, one of Denmark's sort of chief scientists, psychiatrists, saying that, you know, once you think that you're over it, you aren't necessarily. You can have a relapse just as instantly as that. It's not like sort of, you know, bending a broken leg. The brain is far more complicated, and I can certainly bear testament to the fact that, you know, once the tent pegs that are holding the ropes of your mind, once they start sort of ripping off, you can go off in any direction. And I had two phases. One which was manic, which is in the initial phase when I started to believe that I was Christ, and it was an absolutely sort of astonishing sort of period. But that actually was the kind of the nicer period, the more benign period, because a few months later, after I had a couple of relapses, I flipped, the madness flipped, and I started to believe that I was the devil. Now, the psychiatrist says that that's a sort of perfectly normal antidote to somebody who believes that he's been the Messiah.
But it's interesting as to what you were grabbing on to, because, as I understand it, not a particularly religious person, but in Greece, surrounded at times perhaps by religious objects, ancient historical religious buildings, and also hearing the voices of former and dead colleagues.
I do not understand why I suddenly sort of went off on this Messiah complex, but apparently, you know, believing that you are Christ is quite a common sort of complaint sometimes amongst people, you know, with psychiatric problems. So I don't understand why it happened to me. But as you say, I was starting to hear what I thought were voices of my dead friends. I had four friends who covered the siege of Sarajevo with me, who all died later on, very tragic deaths. And when I was in the psychiatric hospital in Athens, I started to believe that I was getting messages from them. And the way in which they would manifest themselves would be, there'd be a kind of an electronic buzz. And it was, and suddenly, I'd be able to see their faces in my mind's eye, and they would set me tasks to prove to other people that I was Christ.
And all of this very much put the brakes on your career with the BBC, to say the least, and led to horrific personal circumstances.
Yes, we lost everything. I mean, the thing is, I mean, to be perfectly honest, I didn't have the best of relationships with the BBC. I was always, you know, very argumentative, and I'm just, you know, I'm not somebody who takes orders very well, and, you know, I'm anti-authoritarian, and I'd fallen out with them. Mm. And this certainly didn't help. And, I came very close to actually broadcasting something that was totally bonkers.
Yeah.
After I had one relapse, and luckily the editors in London caught that. But and when I then sort of surfaced after a second spell in hospital and came back to Greece and tried to kickstart my career, they put restrictions on me, which is, you know, perfectly understandable now. At the time, I was very unhappy about it, but they didn't dare have somebody live on the air who could possibly go off on one.
Yeah. And Trina, you were involved very early on, as I believe, a filmmaker yourself, in capturing Malcolm in these moments of madness, and at his most vulnerable. This must be pretty shocking to you.
I didn't know what to believe, which is why I took out my little iPod and I started to film him, because I wanted to document what was happening to him, because I thought, if I just tell people, no one is going to believe this. You know, he was telling me weird things, like, you know, that his Kindle reader was flying through the room, his dead friends were buzzing him. And I thought, I have to document this. I have to just, you know, keep a record of what's going on with him. And that was just the beginning. Then it got worse and worse. And on most days, actually, he was so psychotic that I could not film him, because when I took out my iPod, he would start directing me, and then he would get upset, and that would enhance, you know, all the badness and the psychosis. So many, many days I could not film him. But on occasion, I got the iPod out, and that is sort of basically half the footage of the film is real-time madness that I'm capturing.
Which is something which isn't really seen. I can't recall having seen it dramatised, of course, but this is first-hand.
This is, you know, first-hand. I mean, one of the big psychotic relapses that my husband had took place in Athens. And on that occasion, he actually filmed it himself, because he thought that the second coming had to be on television. And with his camera skills, he shoots and edits his own TV pieces. He thought that was why he was put on Earth, basically, to capture the second coming. So that completely unique psychotic episode, he actually managed to film himself, and I believe that no one has ever seen anything like this before. I mean, we've shown it to psychiatrists and they are blown away by it.
And at what point did you decide, well, this is more than something to show the doctors, this can actually be a documentary feature?
That came much later. You know, it has taken us 7 years. The road to our premiere at the Cambridge Film Festival has been a 7-year-long journey. First, we had to survive. My husband had to survive. I was not sure that he would survive, but he did, because he's my husband and he, you know, he's so strong. Then, you know, our little family, which includes our son Lucas, had to try to get back on our feet and try to rebuild
Because Lucas was 10, 11
when
all this was going
when
on.
It happened, yeah. And he's now 19. Then we had to rebuild our life as a family, get back on our feet financially. So it has been a very, very, very long road for us to get where we are today. So the idea of actually doing it for a documentary surfaced much later, after we had sort of managed to get back to some kind of normality.
So this is not the sort of thing, obviously, which you're going to pull out like a family movie. So I'm assuming that 4-5 years later, you looked at the footage again and saw yourself, Malcolm, back then. What was your reaction looking at it back on time?
It's to be honest, I've been looking at it with a very sort of professional eye. We thought about how to structure the.
Does it feel like looking at another person?
No, I know it's me in there. No, and I don't recognise any of the kind of the thoughts that come out. Mm. Well, of course I said them, and I remember saying them. But there's no kind of cognizance that's really me. That's another person that was, that had vaccine-induced insanity. That's not me. I'm back to being me.
But for instance, our son Lucas, while we've been editing this, he cannot be in the room. There are certain scenes in the film that are very upsetting. Even when I talk about it now, I get upset.
Yes.
Which are scenes where my husband is having a very severe psychotic breakdown right in front of Lucas, our son. Lucas cannot watch it, and I cannot talk about it.
He simply
cannot bear to be in the room. When we have been editing and we came to that scene, because we had to sort of, edit it together, and it was kind of backwards and forwards how we did that, Lucas, every time, left the room. He cannot bear to listen to it, to see it, and I cannot talk about it without getting upset. So it's not as if, it's just a professional piece of work and we can do this. For me, it's very, very personal.
And it's going to be very interesting for Lucas to be in the cinema on, the 31st of October, to see it all blown up and to know whether he can actually stand it. I mean, he wants to be there because he's written this fantastic song which is ending the film. And so, we want to hear what his music is like coming out from those big speakers. But to see this magnified on a cinema screen is going to be a bit of an ordeal for him.
Hmm. It's a multi-layered story, really, because you've got the elements of your reporting and conversations with some correspondents who you worked with at the time. And then you've got the element of Lucas. And also, I kind of feel in a roundabout way, there's also a bit of a love story in there, really. And your support for each other.
You know what? I take my marriage vows very seriously. But have they been tested? Oh, yes, absolutely. To the limit and beyond. In sickness and in health, for better and for worse. And we've done that part now. But, you do what you have to do. In the situation, I had a severely psychotic husband locked up in a psychiatric ward. I had a traumatized teenage son. I still had to go out and do the food shopping and put food on the table. And you know what? You do it because you have to. I was not making any plans about what to do next week or even tomorrow, perhaps not even the next hour. It was one foot in front of the other every day, because that's what you do. And in a way, that is also what marriage is about. If there is a problem, you work it, and we worked it.
And there is a positive ending to all of this, not with the BBC anymore, but with PBS, and working for what in the States, as I understand it. So it's a pretty big show, one of the main evening news bulletins going out on public television there.
Well, I got lucky. Somebody at the PBS NewsHour saw a story that I did about Islamic terrorism in Denmark, and he liked what he saw, and he gave me a chance. Now, what was interesting was, his name is Justin Kenny.
And we love him.
We love him. And, he gave me a chance when other people wouldn't. Mm. And he was really thinking about, not giving me that chance because of the mental health issues. But he gave me a second chance, and I grabbed it. And it just so happens that, 6 months after starting work with PBS and leaving the BBC behind, I led them, their sort of refugee coverage. And And, you know, gratefully, you know, I got this Peabody Award, which is America's top broadcasting award, which is kind of vindication, actually, professional vindication, because otherwise, to be perfectly honest, I think I would have left the BBC being a very bitter man. But the BBC is fortunate in that PBS gave me an opportunity, so I don't actually think so badly of them.
And at the film festival, at the Picture House, there's going to be a Q&A opportunity as well once the film's been shown.
Yes, and we're looking forward to that very much. And actually, Lucas is going to be up there. And so maybe if he wants to talk about things, he can. But he's looking very much, you know, forward to this because it's a big occasion for him because his song, you know, is up there.
The way Lucas expresses his struggle, because Lucas has been struggling, there is a legacy. For any family with a mentally ill person, there is a legacy. And long-term, Lucas is the one who's going to be carrying that legacy because he saw things as a 12-year-old that no child should ever see. He is, to this very day, still struggling. And the way he expresses his struggle best at the moment is through his music. So he's written Nightmares, and I think the lyrics say it all.
Okay. Thank you both very much.
You're very welcome.
Wow, what a story.
Yeah, and it's all at the Cambridge Film Festival on Wednesday. I've seen the film. Malcolm was good enough to send me an advanced copy ahead of doing that particular interview. It's worth all 80 minutes of watching it.
You can hear sort of, particularly as maybe the wife is speaking about it, she's still quite affected by it. You know, she sounds still quite, like it really hit her hard, obviously.
I think so too, and it's difficult to remember that this was 5-6 years ago that they were, you know, I think I suspect they'll be dealing with it forever to a greater or lesser extent. So you can see it at the Arts Picture House. The film is Malcolm is a Little Unwell, 5:30 on Wednesday, followed by Q&A. A bit behind, but I just wanted to play you a quick snatch of the music of Lucas Brabant, who Trina mentioned towards the end of that interview. Just take a listen to this. That music features in the film. If you want to see it all as a video, which you can take a look at on YouTube, I'll chat with Alex in a moment, possibly about Australia, possibly about 105 today from 9 o'clock.
Cambridge 105 Radio.